With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
This is Talkish. I am Hallie Kesser Jane. Talkish is available at HallieKesserJane.com. This week on Talkish, we're talking politics and Trump 1 year later. Oh, what a year. And they said it wouldn't last. When joining me at my table is the distinguished professor of history at American University and author Alan J. Lichtman, who returns to talk about his hot-off-the-press, updated version of his best-selling book, The Case for Impeachment. And in the second half hour, two people you are going to adore, the gracious authors of Treating People Well, former White House Social Secretaries Lee Berman and Jeremy Bernard. Is civility a thing of the past in the brash age of Trump? It's time for Talkish. Let's talk. Starting first with Professor Alan Lichtman. But before we begin, a little background on Professor Lichtman. He's notable for many reasons, among them that he's correctly forecast 30 years of presidential outcomes. And he continued his forecasting winning streak in the fall of 2016, when he predicted that Donald Trump would defeat the heavily favored Democrat Hillary Clinton to win the presidential election. Then in his best-selling book, The Case for Impeachment, Professor Lichtman turned his focus to President Donald Trump, and his next forecast, that it was not a question of if President Trump would be impeached, but a question of when. Now, on the one-year anniversary of President Trump's inauguration, how time flies when we're having a good time, Lichtman remains convinced that President Trump's days are numbered. In his updated version of The Case for Impeachment, Lichtman lays out the factors that will lead to Trump's removal from office. It's time for Talkish. Let's talk to our old friend, Professor Alan J. Lichtman.
Hi, Alan.
Hi, Hallie. Good to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you again, too. Nice to have you back. And listen to me.
I'm happy to be back.
I am just thrilled you're doing this book and did an update on it, because, whoa, what a year. Oh, my God.
What a year. And we sort of needed the update, which is hot off the press, just came out this week.
It's exciting and it's well done. And I had fun reading it, and everybody else will too when they get it. So listen to me. Oh, my gosh. It has been a year. And Donald Trump, you know what, Alan? The man never disappoints. Drama.
Never.
Surely.
Never changes.
The middle name. How about governing? How do you think he's been doing? Is he your best or worst nightmare? Where are we now after this year?
Well, I think we're in a very dangerous place for our democracy. But don't take my word for it. Listen to a fellow Republican, Jeff Flake, who did something absolutely extraordinary, something I'd never seen before. You know, goes after a president of his own party, not in a minor way, not on some small difference of politics or policy, but goes to the heart of our democracy and says, you know, Donald Trump's abuses of power, particularly his extraordinary attacks on the free press, which go beyond, far beyond anything Richard Nixon even did, are Stalinistic and threaten the survival of democracy in this country. And I go back to Thomas Jefferson, who said, and I'm paraphrasing, given a choice between a free government and a free press, I'll take a free press, because you can't have a free government without a free press. And then, of course, there are his attacks on the judiciary, his disregard for the separation of powers, his governance by tweeting, his ignorance of even the most basic policy issues, and his dividing the country, which may be as serious as anything else. One of the most critical roles of a president is to unite the nation as best you can. And instead, Trump has divided us. He's demeaned people based on their religion, on their race, on their nationality, on their gender. He set one American against another. And his singular, really only big policy accomplishment through legislation, the tax cut bill, makes worse perhaps the most serious economic problem we face, the enormous income inequality in America that is now exceeding that on the eve of the Great Depression. We may get a short sugar high when you're, you know, writing hot checks and ballooning the deficit, but this is really a very dangerous thing to do.
I so agree with you, but you didn't answer my question. Is he worse than you thought he was going to be? Or what? What do you think?
He's worse than I thought he was going to be. Look, I wasn't absolutely certain how he would act. I kind of understood him personally, but I didn't understand him from a policy perspective. After all, at one time, I guess he was kind of a Democrat. He gave money to the Clintons. He was pro-choice. He was strong on fighting climate change. I didn't expect him to go so far to the extreme right. I didn't expect him to be a president continually applauded by David Duke, the former head of the KKK, by the Daily Stormer, the neo-Nazi website, by the white supremacist Richard Spencer. That's really disturbing to see his greatest cheerleaders are neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and Ku Klux Klanners.
It's just bizarre is what it is. I'm going to assume that not everybody knows about impeachment. Certainly you and I talked about it last time when we talked, but give us some of that, because I think people,
yeah,
you know, who knows who's in the audience? Talk about the case for impeachment.
It's an important element of my book, The Case for Impeachment. I go through the history and process. We tend to look at impeachment as this catastrophic event. Not so at all. The framers put impeachment into the Constitution advisedly as a legal and peaceful means of dealing with a rogue president. And they were students of human nature. They knew anyone could become corrupt or dangerous. And this was an alternative to the way in which you dealt with dangerous rulers of their own time in the 18th century by assassination or revolution. We've had two impeachments and one president to resign facing certain impeachment. That's one out of 14 American presidents prior to Donald Trump. And one could argue in each case the republic emerged stronger, not weaker. The impeachment of Andrew Johnson in the 1860s moderated his opposition to integrating the freed slaves into American life. Nixon's resignation removed a threat to our democracy. Despite all the bemoaning of the impeachment of Bill Clinton, the presidency emerged stronger than ever. In addition, the framers did not put impeachment into the courts. They put impeachment into a political body, the House, giving it sole authority to impeach by majority vote, and then giving the Senate sole authority to remove a president by a two-thirds vote. So impeachment is not a strictly legal process. It is a combined legal, moral, and political process. And it doesn't require an indictable crime necessarily, just a severe abuse of power. As Alexander Hamilton said, abuse follows, and I quote this in The Case for Impeachment, from abuse of power that threatens the society itself. And the cases I lay out in The Case for Impeachment, some of them do involve indictable crimes, but the real focus is on an abuse of power that the American people can recognize and understand that threatens our liberties, our freedoms, and our national security.
So I'm going to say this to you, okay? You give eight vulnerabilities in the book, all which make perfect sense to me as to why he might be impeached. How many days into Trump Inc., that's what I call it, before Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller began his Russia inquiry? I mean, let's talk Russia, collusion, obstruction of justice.
Yep.
I mean, my
yes.
gosh.
Yes, I'd like to talk about that because I have a chapter in my original book that I published last April, everyone was deriding impeachment, which of course is now on everyone's lips. I had a chapter on the Russia connection. But I didn't as yet, and because the events hadn't unfolded, talked about obstruction of justice. I now think, based on new events that I outline in the updated case that came out this week, I now think there was a stronger case for obstruction of justice as the one that was voted against Bill Clinton that almost every Republican in the House voted for. And the case against Trump is on a vastly more serious matter than the blue dress and a consensual affair. It's, of course, the centerpiece is the firing of Comey, where astoundingly, in an interview with Lester Holt, and even more astoundingly in a meeting with Russian officials, he admitted was based on the Russia investigation. But there's so much more. There is very credible testimony that he asked Comey, the FBI director, to let go of the Flynn investigation and to pledge personal loyalty to the president, that he pressured heads of the national intelligence community to try to interfere with the investigation, that he pressured members of the Congress to try to stop the investigation. These are precisely the kinds of things that led to the House Judiciary Committee to vote an article of obstruction against Richard Nixon. And, of course, there is Donald Trump's dictating or heavily influencing the very misleading explanation of the infamous June 2016 Trump Tower meeting between Russian operatives Don Jr., Jared Kushner, and campaign chair Paul Manafort. The misleading, false statement from Donald Trump, which I think is part of the obstruction case, said this was all about adopting Russian children. But in the case for impeachment in the update, I actually go through word for word the entire email chain that led to that meeting, and that clearly indicates the purpose of the meeting was to provide incriminating information on Hillary Clinton from the Russian government to help elect Donald Trump. And Don Jr.'s response was, I love it. This is all new information that's in the updated version that represent events that hadn't unfolded when I first wrote the book.
Absolutely, sure. You know, it's interesting, the Russia collusion. I'm sure you would admit it's probably easier to get him on obstruction, right, which is kind of what you just said, rather than...
Right, but less serious in some ways.
Right, but interesting, there's a political thing going on with this. Because you know that the Republicans would far rather we got him on obstruction than get him on Russia, which is pathetic, absolutely pathetic, because the danger to the state, even beyond, in some ways, Donald Trump, is the...
Exactly. Look, you know, conspiring with the... I don't like the word collusion, although I do use it. If the special counsel demonstrate that Trump and his team conspired with the Russians to rig an American election and undermine our democracy, that's clearly the most serious transgression of any president in the history of the country, far surpassing even anything that went on in Watergate. There's a lot of circumstantial evidence already publicly known, and I guarantee to you we've seen just the tip of the iceberg of what Mueller knows. And here's what's so astounding to me. You know, you have Trump making this bogus argument that our democracy is being threatened by voter fraud. You know, that 3 to 5 million illegal voters somehow mysteriously appeared on Election Day. Somehow all of them voted for Hillary Clinton and somehow disappeared without any detection, including by the Republicans who administer most elections in this country. It's false. It's phony. It's been disproved by every single study. Every study shows voter fraud is vanishingly small in American elections. So he and his allies are making this huge bogus case about the threat to our democracy from voter fraud. And meanwhile, they are ignoring the elephant and rhinoceros in the room, which is the threat to our democracy from Russian manipulation of our elections. They have done nothing, zero, sat on their hands to protect the integrity of the American elections from the next time, and we know there's going to be a next time, that Russia or other hostile powers interfere with our democracy. That's a real and present threat, maybe the greatest threat we've ever had to our democracy, and they do nothing and instead raise this bogus red flag of voter fraud. It's astonishing.
It is astonishing, and you would wonder, one would think, they're acting like Russians.
That's right. And maybe they're compromising. You know, there are some who've said, oh, Lichtman, you can't impeach Donald Trump for something that occurred during the campaign. It's got to be something while he was president. False. There's nothing in the Constitution with a time limit on impeachment. There's nothing in the debates at the convention of the Constitution that suggests that. Moreover, clearly, if he was conspiring with the Russians to get elected, that directly implicates the presidency. It directly affects his ability to govern. By the crazy logic of those who say that's not impeachable, they would also have to say, imagine a president who got elected by contracting with the mafia to bump off his opponent, and you don't know about that until after the inauguration. Are they claiming he couldn't be impeached for that? It's nonsensical.
You know, He lies incessantly. One news outlet came up with 2,000 lies. That was
a whole chapter on that.
Right? I mean, that's incredible. And maybe we'll have time to get into it. There's something more that I wanted to get into before we go there, though. Can a president who doesn't know the law be blamed for disregarding the law? Because you do...
Absolutely.
Okay.
Ignorance of the law is absolutely no excuse. It's not an excuse in criminal cases. It's certainly not an excuse in the case of Donald Trump. Remember, people say, oh, Donald Trump is so naive. You know, nonsense. You know, he is an international businessman with, you know, far-flung experiences all over the world. And he has been deeply involved in the political system. In fact, as I point out in the case for impeachment, he largely made his fortune not by being a businessman, but being involved in politics, by getting tax breaks, concessions, easements from governments that enabled him to proceed with his enterprises. So he is not someone who is naive or ignorant. I really bristle when people, you know, try to excuse him on that basis.
Excuse him on any basis. When he took on Flynn, it's been well documented that the one thing that Obama told him was, don't take him on. And he did. Is that a clue to you?
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You on in any of this?
It's a huge clue to me for several things. First of all, I kept him on, even though the acting attorney general warned him that Flynn was likely compromised by the Russians. That tells you a lot. Tells you two things. One, Flynn has said, I have a story to tell. Clearly, Trump does not want Flynn to tell a story, but it may be too late now. Secondly, what was Flynn doing during the transition? He's calling the Russian ambassador about easing the sanctions against Russia. Why would he be doing that? It certainly suggests, and maybe Mueller will have the proof on this, we don't know, that there was some kind of quid pro quo between the Russians intervening on behalf of Trump and then Trump acting to ease the sanctions. There's at least circumstantial evidence of that, and that circumstantial evidence is abetted by the fact that the transition officials knew all about these calls and lied about it. Oh, he was just calling for Christmas greetings or, you know, for some other innocuous purpose. And yet we now know that, in fact, lots of transition officials who were later White House officials knew all about the real purpose of these calls. Lots and lots of smoke, some flame. I think a lot more is going to come out from Mueller. And by the way, you know, 7 or 8 months of a special counsel investigation, that's not a long time. Historically, special counsel investigations have taken years. Mueller is actually moving at a brisk, not a snail's pace.
Particularly with this cast of characters. Oh, my God. We're fighting
goodness.
I mean, right? It's never ending.
Two convictions already.
I know.
Two very serious indictments.
The thought of it. And that brings me on to something, which is this. I mean, you really wonder, of course, about the Republicans. And I don't even know I would call those who were running the House truly Republicans. They're scary to me. They've taken over the Republican Party. The poor folks who are Republicans who can't abide by any of the no Trumpers, if you will, are completely they're like neutered. In fact, everybody is neutered.
Until Mitt Romney gets elected senator.
Well,
boy,
let's
is
hope.
Trump going to
yeah,
rue that
right.
day.
Oh, absolutely. Let's hope. But, you know, that is a point that I do want to talk to you about. And that is the fact that everybody is screaming. Think of it. 35% is all that he's got. 35%. That he is holding the nation and the world by the you-know-whats with 35%. And we are all...
Yep. It's astonishing.
Well, I don't get it. Everybody's kowtowing.
All right, let me say a few things about that. You raise a great point here. I think, you know, Republicans have become, unfortunately, enablers of Donald Trump, with some notable exceptions, like Jeff Flake, the Republican senator from Arizona, who went out and called out Donald Trump for his attacks on the press and undermining our democracy and being Stalinist. But here's a couple of things I think might change the picture even for Republicans. One, again, we don't know what Bob Mueller is going to come up with, but he might come up with things that really shock the world. Direct conspiracy with the Russians. Serious financial crimes. We haven't even talked about that yet. That might finally move some Republicans. Secondly, for office holders, one of the Lichtman rules of politics is their first priority, maybe their only priority, is survival. And if they think Trump is bringing them down as we get towards the 2018 midterms, enough of them may swing over to protect themselves and vote for an impeachment investigation. If not, I think the Democrats are going to take over and control the House. When I first wrote the case for impeachment, I thought that was remote. In my update that came out this week, I point out it's not remote at all anymore.
Right. But I, like I said, I still think there's something very odd in all of this, that we're all being held hostage by the 35%. I also want to say that I love the resist movement. I think it's fantastic coming from the Dems and the Trumpers on the other side. But in a way, it's all verbal. Nobody, and you write about this
in
the new book.
You're so right about that. Right. Look, I say in the book, you know, protest, argument, it's smoke through the chimney unless it's directed towards an end. And if you really believe that there should be an investigation on impeachment of Donald Trump, then you need to act. You need to sign a petition. You need to email your member of Congress, write to your member of Congress, call her or him, visit them. You need to direct your action towards a goal, otherwise it doesn't mean anything in our political system.
A little humor. I imagine Bill Clinton sitting in his cozy house in Chappaqua, New York right now, thinking of himself, how he got impeached for lying over a consensual affair with a lovely...
I know, isn't it astonishing?
Age, you know, a woman of age. I mean, you know, she was in the right time or whatever, and she was a well-educated girl, la da la la la. And here comes Trump and his porn queens like Stormy Daniels. The right.
No, how did that story get? Well, you know, that's a whole other issue. How did that story get buried?
Except to say, there's going to be money in that because somebody paid her off. Where'd the money come from? Rachel Maddow was talking about that last night, and I thought that was brilliant.
That's a really good question.
Because that may be a lead.
And by the way, there is a lawsuit by Summer Zervos, one of his accusers, for defamation that the courts are considering to let go through. Remember the lawsuit by Paula Jones against Bill Clinton, the courts let it go through. And if that happens, then there's going to be all kinds of discovery, right?
Oh, I'm telling you,
and
it'll be
a lot of the seamy stuff may well come out. Plus, Trump would have to testify in a deposition under oath. And we know from his past depositions, he plays fast and loose, to put it mildly, with the truth.
Except he is Teflon Don, and that scares the heck out of me. And the other part that I just want to put a comma on is those who are standing with him are all the Christian zealots. So that's my words, not yours. There you go. But I want to talk. Let's talk.
Yeah, I want you to use those words. I'm not going to use them yet. But look what happened in Wisconsin.
Oh, yesterday. You mean, yeah.
In this rural, solidly Republican district that Trump won by 17 points, the Democrat won by about 10, 27, 26-point swing. And this wasn't a Roy Moore case. You know, the Republican was a pretty standard Republican candidate. I think he was a state House member. And he gets creamed in a district that was solidly blood red that Democrats haven't controlled for a couple of decades. Real warning that, you know, for Republicans. I think they better take this a lot more seriously than they have. They need to all read my book.
Well, I hope they don't take it seriously because I want the guy out. But, okay, that being said, 8 key categories is where you focus in the new version of the book, which I love. There are
Thank
all
you.
Sorts of things. Mental health is one. I mean, you know, and we learned the other day, oh boy, to squash the rumors, you know, he can identify an elephant and what, a hippo?
Nonsense.
I mean, come on, right?
That's not what the case on mental health is about. It's not whether he can repeat a series of numbers, you know, or recognize animal pictures. That's not what the psychiatrists and other mental health professionals who've broken a 50-year-old rule against talking about the mental health of a president. It's not what they warned about. What they warned about is what anyone with eyes can see, and that is this is a president who is so narcissistic, so self-absorbed, that he cares only about himself and looks at other people only as tools for his own advancement and his own aggrandizement, and has no concept of truth or reality. But again, because of his self-absorption. He looks at truth as meaningless. It's simply whatever serves his own purposes is the quote-unquote alternative facts for him at the moment. It's Orwellian. It's truly Orwellian. It's truly hate is love, war is peace. That's the real things we got to worry about, not the things the doctor was talking about.
Absolutely.
That's not the issue.
Right. So the financial issue is Jews. The fact that, you know, he is so embedded and he can be blackmailed from so many ends because he never did divest. And nobody forced him to, by the way, either. What are your thoughts on that? How key a role do you think
that? I think this is, you know, the sleeper issue that no one has really talked very much about. But there's no question that the special counsel is looking into his finances, which could involve a lot of things. As I point out in the case for impeachment, it could involve clear violations of the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution, which says, as president, you can't take anything of value without explicit approval of Congress from foreign entities. And we know he's gotten lots of things of value from foreign entities, including some potentially very lucrative trademarks. But it could also involve financial crimes. In the case for impeachment, I go through the involvement of Donald Trump with some very shady characters in a lot of his financial deals, which might involve crimes like money laundering. And I think the special counsel is likely looking into those things. Why hasn't Donald Trump released any of his taxes? There's nothing to do with his taxes being under audit. A, that's no bar to releasing your taxes. And B, he's got decades of taxes that are no longer under audit. I believe there are some very dubious things in his finances that he doesn't want anyone to see. I can't prove that, but I think the special counsel is looking into it. And I alert people to that in the case for impeachment.
Now, you're making the case for impeachment. You know, there are a lot of people, Alan, who don't want him impeached.
I understand.
I've talked about this a lot too. You know, there's an argument for keeping the useful idiot in power. You know,
I've heard that from my Democratic friends who say we want Donald Trump so we can keep kipping him around.
Well, let me take.
I think that's an abdication.
Well, but there's
of
another
our responsibility.
Well, all right, but there is another part which now I think disputes that as a concept. The argument was always, well, then you get Mike Pence. I think we already have Mike
Maybe,
Pence.
Unless he's involved in all this.
Well, yeah, but I think we already have
assume
Mike
Pence. Assume he's not. Assume he's not.
No, I'm going to assume he's not. I'm going to say to you, I think he's already running the ideological show. I mean, like just today, they started on the abortion stuff again and you know, the whole nonsense, yada, yada, yada. So I think that that's all. I think that's something that needs to be addressed, which is he's getting his clues, Trump, because I don't think that's where he is necessarily ideologically on this right-wing agenda from the likes of Pence. So you already have Pence. So I think that that kind of throws that argument out. And this is moral. That's the point you were just making. We do have a responsibility.
This is a moral responsibility. We can't overlook this for fine-line political calculations. And in fact, my book is not political. Look, I go back to the Eisenhower administration. I've seen a dozen administrations. There are plenty of presidents with whom I've had profound differences on policy and politics. I have never before talked about impeaching a president because I think Trump is a unique threat to our liberties, our freedoms, and our national security.
I think the most important thing that you say in this book, amongst many important things, is the Trump's a great menace. That was your word. I love that word. I'm going to steal it from you. Use it all
yes.
the time. He's a menace of to the presidency, to America, and all that it stands for. And you talk about that. We've got a 1 minute. Talk to me for that 1 minute. His xenophobic nationalism, his authoritarianism. Talk to me.
Yes. I make the point that whatever else you may say about Trump, he represents a throwback to some of the worst elements of American history. He represents a throwback to American isolationism at many levels. Isolationism in terms of we should be isolated from any cultural influences other than those which represent ourselves. Isolationism in the sense that we should wall ourselves off from so-called undesirable immigrants, who at one time were people like my grandparents, you know, Jewish immigrants, are Irish Catholic or Italian immigrants. He represents isolationism in that we should wall ourselves off from any kind of intellectual influence, from any kind of criticism, from any kind of open discussion. I even make the symbolic point that at one time he wanted to build a medieval castle in Manhattan, complete with battlements, a moat, and a wall, much like the old medieval walled cities. That's at essence what he represents.
So, Mr. Predictor.
Oh, please.
Oh, yeah, come on. All right, there are a lot of things,
right,
that, a lot of balls that have to, you know, align up here, if you will.
Right.
But talk to me. What do you think?
It's better than 50-50 that he's not going to survive the 4 years. I'll say that.
Well, let's hope it's on impeachment, because even the worst people shouldn't die, no matter what kind of hamburgers they eat. Thank you, Mr. Lichtman. It's always lovely having you here.
Anytime, Hallie. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye. I've been speaking with Alan J. Lichtman, the Distinguished Professor of History at American University in Washington, D.C., and formerly Associate Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences and Chair of the Department of History. He's the author or co-author of 8 books, including recently FDR and the Jews, which won the National Jewish Book Award in American Jewish History. His new book, the updated version of The Case for Impeachment. To purchase a copy of The Case for Impeachment, visit Amazon.com and find bookstores everywhere. You are listening to Talkish with Hallie Kasser-Jane, The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. My guests today are Professor Alan J. Lichtman, the author of The Case for Impeachment, and Lee Berman and Jeremy Bernard, the authors of Treating People Well. Talkish with Hallie Kasser-Jane. Post new podcasts Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern at HallieKasserJane.com. Now a question. Is civility dead or just temporarily out of fashion? Maybe it's a lost art one day to be recovered. Let's hope so. And soon. Two people out to make civility fashionable again are former White House Social Secretaries Lee Berman, who worked for President George Bush, and former First Lady Laura Bush.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
And Jeremy Bernard, who worked for President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama, who together have written Treating People Well, a guide to personal and professional empowerment through civility and social skills, a book that conveys an important fundamental message. Everyone is important and everyone deserves to be treated well. Not a book of old school etiquette. Treating People Well explains the things we all want to know, like how to walk into a room full of strangers and make friends, what to do about a difficult colleague who makes you dread coming to work each day, and how to navigate the sometimes treacherous waters of social media in a special chapter on virtual manners. And for lovers of White House history, this is a treasure of never-before-published anecdotes and their fellow former social secretaries as they describe pearl-clutching moments with presidents and first ladies dating back to the Johnson administration. It's time for Talkish. Let's talk with Lee Berman and Jeremy Bernard. Hi, Lee. Hi, Jeremy. This is Hallie.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Hi, how are you?
I'm terrific, and I'm really terrific after reading your adorable, fun, fabulous, informative book. Great job.
Oh, good. Thank you so much.
Oh, you
Thank
are
you.
So,
it is an honor
so
to be
welcome.
On.
Well, it's an honor to have you here. It is brilliant, you too. I mean, it's let's take a page out of Miss Manners, okay? Let's do that. Let's start with ladies first, Lee. I love Lee. Lee spelled, by the way, for you guys who are going to go look for the book, is L-E-A. How did you become the social secretary to George and Laura Bush? I mean, you were a shy kid from the farm belt, raised on a grape farm.
I was.
Oh, my God. Talk to me.
That's right. And, you know, I didn't have any kind of growing up experience that would have prepared me to be a social secretary. And in fact, I was a full-time mother for 10 years before I went to work in the White House for the Cheneys for several years. And then I really thought I was finished with government service. And at the beginning of the Bush second term, Mrs. Bush asked me to come in and interview to be her social secretary. And so my experience had really been with the Cheneys before that.
So service, can we talk that word? I love that word, because I think that has a lot to do with what this book really goes into. Jeremy, you want to, before we get into how you got into all of this, can you just address that word, service?
Service, I think, is it's an honor to be a part of the federal government, and it is a big commitment, but it's an honor, and I think service on all of it. I think yesterday was a good example of all the news stories about people doing things for MLK holidays or at food banks and et cetera. Really shows the positive of this country, and it's something we need to focus on more.
I so agree with you, and I love that word. So you, San Antonio, Texas kid, how'd you wind up in the middle of all of this? I love this. Giddy up.
It's always one of those questions where my answer is initially, I'm really not sure. When I was also a very shy kid, and but I started working for the Obamas in 2007. And in 2009, I went into the administration. I was in Paris at the time where I got an email from the chief of staff of the First Lady, said, would you throw your hat in the ring for this job? And I thought, well, yeah, I will, but I won't get it. I don't know that job. And when I came back to D.C., met with the West Wing staff and then met with Mrs. Obama, and I said to her, I just want to be honest with you. I don't know flowers, and I don't know China that well. I'm not certain I'm the right person for the job. And she explained it was really more of having a political sense, not political being Democrat or Republican, but political sense, and how we can get the most people that have never experienced into the White House and make sure they feel welcomed.
So let's put this on the table before we go ahead. Lee, you're a Republican. Jeremy, obviously, is a Democrat. And yet the two of you are great friends, and you've come together to write this great book. How did the writing go, you two?
It was easy because, honestly, Jeremy is a nicer person than I am. And I would write a few pages. And
it's really not true. But
I would send a few pages to him, and he'd say, you know, this is maybe a little pessimistic. How about if we use this story instead, or highlight some other thing that happened that was really very positive? And so I think we were a good combination in that way. And it also was possible because even though we came from very different administrations, our experiences as social secretaries were remarkably similar. You have nervous people coming into the White House every day, and you need to make them feel welcome and reassured. And the tricks and the techniques we learned in doing that are what we put into the book so that everyone can benefit from the mistakes we made along the way.
So here's something that's interesting to me, which is you guys were picked for these jobs. So obviously somebody somewhere to both of you felt that you were the kind of character that and personality that, you know, went hand in hand with the job. So I'm assuming that some of these skills you guys had embedded in you from your childhood in San Antonio and yours on the grape farm. I mean, so, but these, but these can be taught. And that's the point of your book, which I find fascinating because, you know, let's just take Hallie. You can tell I'm a pretty big personality with a big mouth and I push ahead. I wouldn't have been good at that job, but you're telling me that I can learn to harness, right? And talk to me about that.
I think you could probably be great at that job. It really is. Look, we have to, I was talking to Lee about the fact that sometimes I have to think about what we just wrote when I'm in traffic in the car. I'm in Los Angeles now, living in Los Angeles now. So that traffic in Los Angeles is always, really can make people act the worst. And so I have to think, like, do I need to honk? Really? This isn't a life or death situation. So it's going to take one more minute or 30 seconds. And it's just little steps that can make it better for everyone, and it doesn't mean this huge change. When I was a kid, I was at a restaurant with my family, and the waiter put down an iced tea for me, and I was talking to my brother, and I didn't see. And my dad said, "Jeremy, you can't ignore people." And I was like, "What?" He goes, "Someone just put down iced tea. That's not your servant. You've got to acknowledge them and thank them." And it stuck with me. And I think things like that are really important, that you acknowledge and see people in the moment. And don't be on your phone or you have your earpiece in, et cetera. It's really important.
So I would have to say, and this is kind of what I was thinking as I was reading along, the heart of civility lies in that age-old adage, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Think of others as you would want them to think about you. Treat people the way you want to be treated. Is that what's missing in society today? Just kindness or care? Lee, what do you think?
I think you're exactly right. I mean, I agree with you. And what we have forgotten, I think, is when you treat people well, they almost always respond in kind, and they treat you well in return. They give you respect. They begin to trust you. They turn acquaintances into friendships because they're getting to know you and know that you're a person that they value. And it just makes life so much easier. It takes a lot of stress out of daily life. You know, if you say thank you to the store clerk and look her in the eye, or you hold a door open for someone, these little things are these tiny moments in the course of a day that, on balance, if they're more positive than negative, affects how you feel every day. And then it changes how you feel about yourself, because you start to think of yourself as a pretty decent person, gives you self-confidence, makes you willing to try new things. I mean, it's just a sort of a virtuous circle of good effect.
I love your voice. I could have you around all day just calming me down.
Doesn't she have the perfect voice?
Right?
She has the perfect voice.
I mean, it's like
very calming and very clear.
And no threat. And I want to bring that up because I think that's a lot of it. I think people today are coming from a place of constantly feeling threatened. They have to prove their point. They have to. Everybody is insecure, right? I mean, so one of the things.
Well, I think people. I'm sorry.
No.
I think people are so used to, because of 24/7 news and all the social media, all which brings with it a lot of positive, but it also makes it harder to take that moment and think before you respond. You know, how many of, you know, I have been guilty of, who have sent an email to someone and then later thought, why did I do that? Step away, think about it, do it later, either the next day or at least an hour or two later. Think about, this is there forever, and how do I want to be perceived? But it's very easy. Bad behavior is contagious, so it takes a real effort to stop, take a moment, and think about, wait, what if the shoe was on the other foot?
I like the concept of slowing down. Huh, how do you like that one? Can we? Is it possible? It's like the world gets faster and faster, and I don't know if that's because that happens when you get older and older, or it's just what's happening. Lee, talk to us about the job of social secretary, because I'm not sure that people really understand just what an extraordinary list of things that go into what is your job as social secretary. Talk to me about that a little bit.
You know, the White House Social Secretary is responsible for every event that takes place on the White House grounds, with the exception of what happens in the Oval Office and the press room. And so it is a high-volume event planning operation with a very small staff. And it's not just parties, but it's press statements and bill signings and one-on-one luncheons or dinners with the president and his counterpart, or the first lady and a friend. And so there are multiple things often in the course of a day, and hundreds of events over the course of a year. And then at the holiday season, it becomes most intense, where we had, I think, 24 parties in 21 days, and it was maybe 12 or 13,000 people who actually came in the door. And all of those people require security information to be cleared. And so it's a big undertaking from a small group of people.
And it's a jack of all trades to boot. First of all, let me also bring this up, let me bring up the historical anecdotes in the book, which are fantastic, and not just the current, your administrations, but I'm glad that you went back to the early social secretaries and that. But there is also some crazy stuff that goes on. Math, having to figure out what was that paragraph in the book, Jeremy, about, you know, you have to do the numbers because you've got these massive amounts of...
Right, because you have to figure out how many, you know, it's not easy getting into the White House for anyone, including as a guest, because you have submitted your Social Security number, birth date, a lot of information. For many people, that's not something they like doing, though they're getting more and more used to it in this world. But you still have to go through the Secret Service, through the metal detector and all that. So it really is, you know, it has to be almost an exact science. Well, how many people, if we invite this many people and this many people come, how long will it take to get them through the security checkpoint? And that was important on things like 4th of July, where there were several different functions going on, but toward the end, there was, you know, 4,000 to 5,000 people on the lawn watching fireworks. All of them had to be cleared before they got in.
It's fascinating. It's utterly fascinating. And could you work in a place where perfection is any more required than the perfection that, you know, this is the seat of power really for the world, that you guys were in charge of putting the best foot forward on? Can I bow to both of you for this? I mean, to me, it's an extraordinary achievement that you could pull it off. And as far as I can tell, there weren't too many gaffes along the way. But let's talk about
thank
this.
Thank goodness.
Right? I mean, I can't imagine. I mean, you'd be living with those the rest of your life. But, you know, this is interesting also. It's a dog-eat-dog world in that power center. It has to be. You'll never... But you guys come at it, both of you, and it's so clear in the book, it comes out, how positive-thinking both of you people are. Now, you worked with the Obamas, Jeremy. I imagine the stress level was amazing. And yet you paint them as both utterly kind and considerate people. Come on. They never lose their cool. Come on. Nobody's listening. Tell us the truth. When the camera's on...
Well, what's amazing, they really are amazing people to work for, and they were always they were very good to me. As I say to everyone, you know, they're humans, so they have good days and bad days like anyone else, but their behavior was such, it really made it an honor, and it made that in an odd way made that stress level. You never wanted to do anything that would embarrass the president or first lady, so it made it, I think Lee and I both learned out of fear how to be really careful
and respectful, it sounds to
That's
me.
That's true. We never wanted to embarrass them, but we also realized, or at least I realized after a certain point, that I was trying too hard to be perfect, and perfection is not achievable by humans, and I was twisted up in knots worrying about it. And when I finally realized that mistakes happen, previous social secretaries made mistakes, future ones will probably make mistakes, and you live to tell the tale, and it helps you relax a bit and begin to enjoy the job more, which I think is true for anyone in any job. You know, it's good to have a little perspective. It's not the end of the world if you make a mistake.
Absolutely, and always going forward, and hopefully learning from if there is a gaffe or a mistake, then you go forward and learn from that gaffe or mistake. But it's also right. I mean, because if you can't beat yourself up, you'll never be able to get out of bed, particularly in a job of that kind of power. And you know, if you're not going for, if you can't get reach perfection, you're certainly going for it more than, and in a better way or a different way than everybody else has to do. Laura Bush, come on. She is charming and practical and self-controlled as she seems, Lee. Come on.
You know,
and he is adorable as he seems. I like the word adorable fits him, I think.
You know, they're both just really what you see is what you get. She's very straightforward. She's very kind. She used to come down to the East Wing and pop her head in my office and say in the friendliest way, what are you working on? And then she'd sit down and I'd show her what we were doing. You know, we were planting flowers, or here's some photos, or here's a recipe I was thinking about for a particular luncheon. And then she would leave and go to the next office, and she worked her way around the East Wing. And it was a really useful exercise for two reasons. It taught me how to be a good manager, because that is a way of showing the people who work for you that you care about what they're doing, and you're sort of in the same game together. It's a team building kind of exercise. But it also built tremendous loyalty from me for her, because she clearly cared about not just me, but what we were all doing. And so I learned a lot from her. I learned a lot from her about hospitality, because she's very detail oriented and she wanted to make sure people had an, you know, exceptional experience when they came to the White House.
My friend wanted me to ask you, does she have a sense of humor?
Yes. She's very funny, but, you know, she's quiet about it. And I kind of relate to that because I'm a pretty quiet person myself. You know, like, you never know when someone like that is about to say something very surprising. It's that kind of humor.
And I've had a bunch of people who worked in the White House on the show, or people who've written books about the White House, from the gardens to the staff, you know, those books. And I'm always fascinated by what goes on there. You know, something key, having, you know, kind of over the years spent so much time on the subject of the goings-on, not having been there, Jeremy, is respect. Lee talked about loyalty, but I think, is it passed on generationally through those halls that everybody is respectful of everybody else?
I'm not certain that it is passed on, but I hope it is, and I think overall, and for the most part, it is. I believe that, you know, I would watch people from the opposite party or someone that was a Democrat and watch their reaction as they walked through the halls and into the different rooms. And it was amazing. I had to remember how it was for me. And each time you go in, or for a lot of people, it's once in a lifetime. But it's a real respect for the office. I think that, you know, as soon as someone is president of the United States and you address them as Mr. President, and with it and the surrounding, it there is a different aura. And I think there's a respect throughout.
Yeah. The building heave with all of the extraordinary brilliance and whatever that's lived in that house. You know, I once lived in a 200-year-old house, and I swear it speaks of the people who were there before it, as I'm sure this one does too.
Sure.
A funny little piece that you put in there was, we don't realize, I've been in it, but the rooms are small. It was built at a time when people were smaller.
Yes.
And I think that's worth talking about. One of you want to pick that up? Because that makes it different when you put a party together.
It is different, and it's always surprising to entertainers who expect there to be a rehearsal space and dressing rooms and all of these things. And that's actually very limited there. And there are little nooks and crannies, and you know, you might see an opening in what you think is a wall, but it's actually a doorway, and there'll be a spiral staircase down to a tiny, tiny dressing room. The pastry shop, for example, is maybe 8 feet by 4 feet, and you access it through a tiny spiral staircase. It's actually between the floors, and there's a very small elevator, and I always used to marvel at how they would move these enormous cakes and other desserts safely when there was so little room to operate. But people become used to it. There's a tiny little chocolate room on the ground floor that is all stainless steel, and that's where they go to make their confections and the gifts that they give people of chocolate. And it always smells like chocolate as you walk by, whether someone's working in there or not. And then one of my favorite things to see on the ground floor is, as you walk by, some of the stonework has scorch marks, which were from the War of 1812 when the British came and burned the White House.
Amazing, isn't it? Just, oh, God, don't you love history? The book deals with people skills. You offer 12 practices that you say are the cornerstones in the art of treating people well. Treating people well, folks. That's the name of the book. Again, go get it. Here's something. You tell a great story about Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher in making part of your case about the story of self-confidence. One of you want to pick that one up? It's cute. Yeah?
Sure. It really did. You know, here's the Iron Lady, and you just, a natural reaction is that you would never see her ever be uncertain or not, or wanting reassurance. And after her remarks at a Medal of Freedom ceremony, where she was honored by George Herbert Walker Bush, she said after her remarks, "Was that okay?" to Kathy Fenton. And it just showed, wow, everyone has their insecurities, and confidence is not easy.
Lee, you have anything to say on that subject? Or?
Well, you know, confidence is the first element we all need to go on to treat people well. You have to have a positive attitude. You need to be prepared. And you need to be reassured, as Margaret Thatcher did, because everyone needs that from time to time. And from there, you can feel comfortable enough to make a joke to your boss that allows the two of you to relax and maybe make more of a connection than you might be able to do otherwise, or to be charming and say something that really makes someone warm to you, and begin to do some of the other things that we talk about, like how to listen actively to what someone says and give them an opportunity to respond and give yourself the opportunity to really listen carefully to what someone is telling you, because they often don't say exactly what they want, and you have to figure that out and read between the lines, and how to keep very calm and keep your game face on no matter how you feel inside. And then, you know, all of this sounds very happy and positive, but there are people in the world who are difficult and intransigent, and we write about how you have to deal with people like that, because for people like that, being pleasant is a weakness to be exploited, and you can't just be nice to them. It won't work.
So you're going to tell me who was the most difficult person you dealt with?
Usually,
absolutely not.
See, that's why you're the ones to write the book. You'd ask me, I'd say, yeah, I'll tell you who. You want to hear this story?
That's what was great about the former socials, is that they are this sorority and me of people that experienced it. And so sometimes there would be those days, and I would ask Lee or Gail, who worked for Reagan, are you free for a drink or for lunch? And it usually was a drink. And it was, and I would be telling things that, oh gosh, I had to deal with this and this ego, this person, that. And you heard the other people say, you know, I had something very similar. And that was a great release for us.
I'll bet it was. You know,
the other thing it taught us was to be not so judgmental of people, because there's a steady stream of famous people coming through the White House every day, and we have preconceptions. And you'd meet someone that you have always admired, you thought was the most wonderful person in the world, and they were jerks. And then you'd meet someone you always thought was a jerk, and they couldn't have been nicer. And so it forces you to say, I have to take people at face value. I just can't prejudge them based on what I've read or what I've heard about them.
I can just imagine. But you have an interesting perspective on history, because you're in the fishbowl. And it must be interesting to be in the fishbowl and see how the great people who would probably, some many who would want to be in that fishbowl, come into the White House and look at that world. But that must have been fascinating for you to see how great either heads of state or diplomats or even the great performers of the world would come in. I imagine they were cowed as much as you two were, as you tell in the book, the stories of, you know, that first day at work. Oh, my God, what have I gotten myself into?
Sure,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, I just...
It also may... Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go. We're on a little delay, that's why this is happening.
You brought up something that made me think of a good point, and that is, we get so busy in those jobs, and it was really important to, at the end of the day, think about... Sometimes I'd sit in the office and just think, and as it got quiet, I would think about, maybe we had three events that day or four events, I would think about how amazing that was and what historical, you know, significance they have. And I would tell my staff, we are so busy, and we don't have enough people, and we're always trying to catch up, but don't forget to look and enjoy the moment and to enjoy this amazing ride, because it doesn't last forever.
Yeah, that's it. And you've got to be mindful all the time, I'm sure, those coming in and those who are in, you know, we are lucky people right now to be experiencing all of this. There's some humor in this, and we need to talk a little bit, because there are some funny stories along the way of things that you happen to have witnessed, people getting out of maybe drinking too much or something. Lee, you want to tell us a funny, or Jeremy?
Well, it's not unusual for people to get a little bit too much to drink at the White House once they get there, because they're very excited and they don't really realize, you know, how much that they're imbibing. But I have been there waiting to welcome a senator who was coming for a meeting with the president, and I watched him pull up to the north portico and the door opened, and I saw him take out some mouthwash and swirl some mouthwash around in his mouth and spit it out on the steps of the White House, and then get out and weave up the steps to his meeting. And it's, I'm sure, not the only time that's ever happened at the White House, but Even I was shocked by that.
Oh, my God. There's a great quote. You quote Maya Angelou. I love this quote. People will forget what you said. People will forget what you did. But people will never forget how you made them feel. Is that the key, Jeremy?
That is the key. And I write some in there's a part where I talk about when I was a cater waiter and working at these different things and how people treated me. I still remember, and especially if it's someone that I Frank Sinatra or Johnny Carson, they were so nice. And it stays with you and you want to be like that. And the ones that aren't so great, you realize, you know, that's the last thing I want to be thought of is, oh yeah, the person really wasn't that nice, but it really does stick with you.
So my last question to both of you, Lee first, most inspiring moment you witnessed and experienced in that job?
I remember a time when we were doing something called the iftar dinner, and that is the breaking of the fast after the Muslim holiday of Ramadan. And we had invited all of the ambassadors who had populations of Muslim countries and a number of imams and other prominent people of the Muslim faith. And it was very specific that there had to be a prayer service, and the East Room was prepared, the portraits were covered, prayer rugs were put down, and an imam stood outside the East Room and called people to prayer in the East Room, which was followed by a breaking of the fast and a meal. And this was at a time when the war in Iraq was not going very well. And I remember standing there and listening to this imam calling people to prayer and thinking, this is the ideal of American tolerance, that we are at war with the terrorists, but we are able to differentiate that the religion is not what we're warring against, and I'm proud to be here today.
And you, Jeremy?
You know, there are a lot of them, things like the inauguration, but what really sticks in my mind is something that happened before an event, and that was one of the evenings, the Gershwin Award, for a PBS in performance at the White House event, happened to be taped on the day President Obama said he was not opposed to gay marriage. And I had a moment after the entertainment came in and got their photos with the President and First Lady, and it was just me with the President and First Lady, and we were just talking as friends, and I said, I've got to tell you, I think this is the proudest day of my life. It means so much. And he gave me a hug, and he goes, you know how I felt. You know how I felt. And he goes, but that damn Biden beat me to it. So he had a sense of humor about it, but it was really, for me personally, a very moving day.
Yeah, you're the first.
And it was a great honor to be able to tell them.
You're the first gay man to work in that job, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. You guys got to work with very phenomenal people. Whether we believe in their politics or we don't, they're great people. But you know what? They picked two pretty phenomenal people to work for them. So there you go. This is
that's kind of you.
Thank you. This is really a wonderful, wonderful book. I hope everybody will pick it up. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. We enjoyed
it. Thank you so much.
I've been speaking with Lee Berman and Jeremy Bernard, the authors of Treating People Well. To purchase the book, visit Amazon.com and find bookstores everywhere. Thank you so much for tuning in to Talkish with Hallie Kasser-Jane, The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, a production of Resec LLC. Be sure to tune in to Talkish Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern, when new podcasts are posted at HallieKasserJane.com. Until next time, this is Hallie Kasser-Jane. It's a wrap.